next here tonight, a Brian Ross investigation about a popular brand of products. You may have heard the name, perhaps they're in your home, Herbalife. The company says its shakes and supplements help you lose weight, live a healthy life. But tonight, hidden cameras show what some of the distributors said behind closed doors.
I don't know if you saw that last night, folks, on ABC. But I thought, here we go again. What can you believe anymore when it comes to your health? Who can you believe? And that's why I love having Pam Colleen in every Thursday. Welcome, Pam Colleen.
Good morning, Andy. How are you today?
You think I'm in love with Diane Sawyer. I just happen to watch ABC every night, and there she was again last night, Herbalife.
I mean, some pretty wild claims out there.
Oh, yeah. Herbalife products can cure brain cancer.
It's just but it's a free market, you know, to defend the free market. It's a free market. So people can go out and say and do whatever they seem to want to do.
And
you have to be discerning as a consumer. That's the real point here.
Discerning. Yeah.
You have to be discerning. You have to protect yourself because we do live in a free market. And happened in the 1800s, Andy? In the 1800s, the landscape was full of natural health practitioners, for example. And if somebody wasn't getting people well, then they would just go out of business. So just by default, people find what works. Today, we have a saturated market. We have more sick people today than we had in the 1800s. I mean, we just have a very different scenario going on today. And that's why people need to be that much more protective over their health.
The focus this morning is vegans, vegetarians.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a big fat lie.
Mm-hmm.
You've lived it.
Oh, almost died it. I mean, it almost killed me, a vegan diet. So I did it for 9 years thinking it was going to help me overcome my chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, multiple chemical sensitivities. And the irony in a vegan diet, unfortunately, is that a lot of people actually do feel better at first. And that's what keeps the illusion going, so to speak. But at any rate, over time, of course, everything kept backfiring on me. And you can't believe it's the diet because at first it can make you feel much better, much healthier. So after 9 years, of course, it almost killed me. And that's the focus of a lot of the work that I do is I work with a lot of recovering vegetarians and vegans. And they're all kicking themselves now for having made that choice.
Who was it? You were just sharing an awesome story before we introduce our guest of the because people are so cynical because it's a religion. Being a vegan is religion. Being vegetarian, it's like a religion.
Right.
It's like turning on God.
Very difficult for them to let go of, the vegetarian and vegan diets because the propaganda behind these diets is so incredibly believable. I believed it back in the 90s, for example. And then back in the 90s, the counter information wasn't there. The information to basically divulge the propaganda. Today, it's easy to find, the problems with a vegetarian and vegan diet. More and more vegetarians and vegans are coming forward to report their side effects. And this is not the first author we've had on the show who's written a book this subject.
We better get to her. We've got a lot of territory to cover. Mm-hmm. Beyond Broccoli. I like the title. Sort of says it all. I love those two-word titles.
It's a great title, yeah.
Beyond Broccoli. Creating a biologically balanced diet when a vegetarian diet does not work. Welcome this morning, Susan Shank. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
And tell us where you are talking to us from. I can't believe the way Pam Colleen goes around the world finding these amazing authors and guests. You are in the country of?
Well, I'm formerly from California, but right now I'm retired in Cuenca, Ecuador.
How beautiful.
Ecuador. Mm-hmm. And what's the climate like there today?
It's kind of rainy here. Cloudy and rainy.
Okay. Susan, let's just summarize your book in 30 seconds, and then we'll get into the details.
Okay, well, my book talks about how I was a raw vegan for about 8 years, and then I started getting all these health deficiencies, and my mentor was a doctor who's 96 years old, and he mentored me to gradually introduce animal products back into my diet, and then I started doing a lot of research, and I found out that that's the way we're supposed to be eating. That's the way we evolved eating.
That's right. Your book is full of research, Susan. I am so pleased to see the amount of research that you've done. And in fact, you have a friend who's an anthropologist who helped guide you through some of this information as well. That was a very interesting part of your book.
Yes.
Maybe you can share some of that.
The dietary history of man. It's a myth of it. I dispel quite a few, I think something like 22 vegetarian myths in my book. And one of them is that we evolved not eating meat, which is totally the opposite. We were hunters and gatherers.
That's right.
Let's go through some of those myths. You say there are 22 of them. Just give us a 5 or 6 to give us a flavor of some of the myths that we have been spoon-fed to the point where so many people have, in fact, become vegetarians.
Oh, okay. Well, one of the myths is that eating meat is unnatural and disgusting, chosen only by conditioning. Another is that we need to become vegetarians for global food sustainability. You can't reach high spiritual planes when eating flesh. You can't reach peak health as a meat eater. One of my favorites, vegetarians live 7 to 9 years longer. False.
I know that's not true, yeah. Yeah.
Vegetarian ages more slowly and looks younger. False.
Pam, what's the reality in terms of how longer or what period of time people, vegetarians live?
The trouble I see when people come to me and they've been vegetarian or vegan is I see the brain fog, the depression, the fatigue, the insomnia, infertility issues, the low or no libido. You know, the vegan diet was originally invented to basically kill the libido. That was the intent of a vegan diet from the get-go.
Really?
Who wants to kill the libido?
I know. That's how is that sustainable? You know, it's not sustainable, obviously.
Yeah, I can testify that was definitely the case.
Well, we've had other guests on the show, John Nicholson. We've had Marilyn Diamond. We've had other recovering vegans on the show as well. And it's a common thread. It's a common thing that we see with vegans. And unfortunately, those who do stick with the diet suffer with these side effects, oftentimes they just suffer in silence and won't admit to them because they can look fine on the outside, but they're struggling big time on the
outside. Susan Pam, as you can tell, very, very passionate about this. She lived 9 years as a vegan and almost died. What prompted your passion to write this book, Beyond Broccoli?
Well, I had written a best-selling book on the raw food vegan diet, The Live Food Factor. And even though I still believe in eating as high of a raw diet as possible, I've now converted to see that the high raw, high paleo diet is much, much better and healthier. I was losing my memory because some people are just not good converters of, for example, some people can get the omega-3 from flaxseed and they can convert it to DHA for the brain and EPA for the brain well-being and DHA for the intellect. But other people, and especially as we get older, we're not that good at converting these things. So I was literally losing my memory, and I was also suffering a severe B12 deficiency. My liver had stored up enough that I got by for about 6 or 7 years. But when that was depleted, boy, I was really getting nervous twitches and memory loss to the point where at one point I couldn't even remember my husband's name.
Wow.
That is...
That's a very common complaint I hear from people who are vegetarian and
vegan.
Tell me about that.
Susan, tell me about that moment. You could not remember your husband's name?
Yeah. And, well, you know, we always had nicknames for each other and everything. But when I couldn't remember his real name for a few seconds, it was like on the tip of my tongue. That's when I thought, there's something really wrong.
And a lot of the reason why you do this work as well is to warn parents-to-be, mothers-to-be in particular. And I've seen devastation from mothers who have been vegetarian or vegan and unfortunately had children. And I get to see, sadly, tragically, the effects in the children. And I know that's a big part of what you're doing, and I really respect that because I think women in particular need to be warned. So why is it that you have picked up on this particular platform?
Well, because when I was very, very active in the vegan community. I was doing workshops, seminars, you know, talks at the seminars and all that. And I saw these vegan children, and sometimes the babies would have really small heads, which I found out while writing Beyond Broccoli. That's a really bad sign. The baby will not be as intelligent. You've got that first year and a half window of time to really boost your baby's brain power. And it's not going to happen on a vegetarian, especially vegan, diet because, according to my research, our brains evolve by eating these fatty fish really rich in DHA. And so when you're depriving your child of those nutrients, it can be devastating. And one little boy, vegan, that I met was, he was intelligent, but he had temper tantrums all the time. He was not getting any dietary cholesterol.
That's right.
None.
Yeah. And this is a pervasive critical. Problem, even with people who are eating the standard American diet, is they're still not getting enough animal fat in the diet. And unfortunately, we're seeing the fallout with our children with so many mood disorders today.
Susan, yeah. let's go down the list in terms of the groups that you're most concerned about being vegan. I take it women who are expecting children are at the top of the list.
Yes, and growing children. Those, you know, their brain is still developing, and if they're not getting the nutrients, also their growth can be stunted by not getting enough vitamin K2, because humans are not good at converting vitamin K1 from the greens to vitamin K2. So our ancestors would traditionally boil bones and get a lot of the nutrients needed to build bones by boiling the bones of animals. They would eat the organs to get most of the superfoods, the really, really rich. The organs are the richest in nutrients. Now, in the United States, we just eat muscle meat. We're missing out. Even people who are eating meat are missing out on so many nutrients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of phobia over eating things like meat and, you know, the skin on chicken and so on. I mean, people are terrified of animal fat. And in your book, you talk about the big fat lie. Now I think you're probably seeing, Susan, a lot of the changes in the media actually now countering this misinformation campaign that we've been hearing about for so many decades. You must be thrilled to see that some of the information is coming forward.
Yes, finally people are realizing that the brain needs saturated fat. The brain needs cholesterol. And see, the big pharmaceutical companies, their bread and butter are the statins for lowering cholesterol. So they've actually falsely lowered the safe cholesterol limits just to sell more drugs.
That's right. And they keep trying to lower the limits. I mean, it's almost like, well, we know that the numbers are arbitrary, but they keep making them more and more arbitrary by trying to lower them. And the lower they make them, then the more people they can get on statins.
Susan, let me ask you about one quote in the book under the heading Falling for the Big Fat Lie. You quote Richard Bernstein from the Diabetes Diet as saying, for years, heart attack food was synonymous with red meat, eggs, and butter. How prevalent is that attitude still?
I think it's still it's been so ingrained since the 70s, you know, because I have a whole chapter of that in my book about how they wanted to sell these vegetable oils and they wanted to sell the grains. So they, you know, the corporations arranged to have that all be on the food pyramid and everything and the four basic food groups. And now we know that it's really a high sugar diet that's really going to cause a heart attack much more than any of these animal fats.
Now, you talk about the shrinking brain in your book as well, and there is a lot of research now to show that for several generations now, our brains are actually shrinking in size.
And we're not getting enough DHA. Mm-hmm. We're eating a really, really, really bad diet, as I'm sure you know.
Right. We've been displacing the nutrient-dense animal foods and replacing them with more of the nutrient-deficient foods now for hundreds of years, unfortunately.
Yeah,
you know, the food industry.
The processed foods came out in the 50s and 60s.
You have a great section.
Really,
yeah, you have a great section in your book where you talk about vegetarianism itself and how it came to be as a knee-jerk reaction to an overpopulation problem. And of course,
in Asia,
and plants. Of course, plant foods are easier to produce, easier to ship, have better shelf life, and are more profitable than animal foods. So we've seen this transition going on here in North America now for a couple of generations, for sure.
Okay, now we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to cover a lot of territory, Susan, in that time. Now, the book is called Beyond Broccoli, but then the subcaption is Creating a Biologically Balanced Diet When a Vegetarian Diet Doesn't Work. So you're not saying throw the broccoli in the garbage and just eat steak every night.
No, meat's gotten a bad rap in part because of the factory farm meat, but also because Americans have been brainwashed to eat twice as much meat as what we need. We really do need a high plant diet, but we still need at least 4 ounces of meat every day, you know. So we still should be getting all the antioxidants and fiber from a high plant diet.
And
I don't think we should throw away that, but we do need to get our eggs and animal protein.
So give us what you're having for dinner tonight.
Well, I have dinner for breakfast. I always eat my meat or eggs for breakfast, because I really do well with a high protein. And then for dinner, I just have vegetables.
Now, do you have access to pasture-raised foods in Ecuador?
Pasteurized?
No, pasture-raised.
Pasture, yes. That's one of the reasons I moved here.
That's what I thought, yeah.
The animals are eating their true diet of grass. The cows are free-range eating grass. I see them all the time out there eating the grass. They're not factory farmed and shot up with all these vaccinations, steroids, hormones, antibiotics, and so forth.
That's a problem we quite often get in reaction to this show, Susan, is I want to go with more meat, but then I hear about all these hormones and other chemicals that are used on cattle and pigs and chickens.
Yeah. What I always tell people is pay twice as much for the good meat, but eat half as much, and your bill's going to be the same.
That's one way to do it.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes left, Susan. They're yours. Wrap it up, put a bow on it. What is your advice? Susan Schenck, the author of Beyond Broccoli. Go ahead.
Okay, get away from all, don't eat out very much, because they almost always use the factory farm meat, and they also use the cheap vegetable oils, whereas the good oils would be, you know, butter, coconut butter, olive oil. Those are a lot more expensive, so eat at home as much as you can. Eat a lot of superfoods. Never drink tap water. just do the best you can with what you've got.
Real quickly about the water, why never drink tap water?
Oh, the pipes are all rusty and filled with, when you drink tap water, you're drinking all the, people have peed in all the drugs and everything. And I don't know about in Canada, but in the U.S. they put fluoride in the water, which mm-hmm. Calcifies your pineal gland, lowers your IQ by 10 points.
Mm-hmm.
And main ingredient in Prozac.
Yeah,
we get our water from Lake Erie just after it goes through Detroit. Yeah. Could that be an issue?
I don't know how the water is. If you guys put fluoride,
yeah, the Great Lakes water is not too clean, Andy.
But get a filter. Just get a good water filter.
Okay, Susan, your friends. You used to be a leading figure in the vegan world, the vegetarian world. Now you've gone to the other side with this book, Beyond Broccoli. Are they throwing rutabagas at you?
A lot of people were very upset about what I did, and they did YouTube videos, you know, calling me Satan incarnate.
I know, Susan, I saw what happened, and I see this all the time. I give you a lot of credit for coming forward to do this. You were very brave.
Thank you.
And there's a little bit of less broccoli throwing and rutabaga throwing in Ecuador. Is that part of why you moved there?
Well, yeah, I moved here because I wanted to retire, and it's a lot cheaper here. But, you know, the plus is that we do have a lot of really good meat here.
One quick question. Susan, if you live in the perfect country, you eat the perfect diet, and you have relatively good genes, how long should you live?
I would think towards 100, although now with Fukushima, all bets are off, you know, because of this pollution, that uranium that's going around.
Yeah, we have so many stressors on our body today, Andy, that are so new, so new to
you
us.
You would say, do you think Fukushima by itself is reducing the life expectancy of people literally around the globe?
I think unless we can do something really fast, I think that's a very strong possibility.
By a month or 6 months, a year, 2 years?
Well, in 10 years, people could start dying of thyroid cancer if this thing isn't handled.
Wow, that is...
That's another good reason to be on the Southern Hemisphere. You're buying 20 or 30 years.
Hmm.
Wow. Well, I see the junk, the debris from Japan, from Fukushima, is still washing up on the shores, the western mm-hmm. shores of North America. It's pretty scary stuff.
It really is, yeah.
Okay, so the book is called Beyond Broccoli. Pam, where can people get the book?
I couldn't find a website for you, Susan. Do you have a website?
Amazon.
Just go to Amazon, and I do have a link to your book on my website.
And to our friend Jerry, who always wants a phone number. Is there any way he can call a phone number? Maybe he can phone
Amazon. The library has the book.
Okay.
Yeah, ask at the library, the local library, and see if they have a copy of your book there.
Susan, really appreciate you joining us from Ecuador. Tell us one thing about Ecuador we didn't know. Not that there's anything we know about Ecuador, but if there's one thing important to know about Ecuador, it is, besides the fact that it's your home.
You can live here and live a really good life, including eating out a couple times a week, with about $800 a month. $800 US a month.
Wow.
Yeah, you hear a lot about people from the States retiring in these countries, and they do very well, very relaxed life.
Oh, it's paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow, terrific. Okay, Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Susan.
So much.
It always amazes me. You go beat the jungles to find these people. Absolutely amazing, isn't it? With technology today, you can find them anywhere. Okay, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to switch channels because there are all these media reports in London of people dying from the flu. Give me 10 seconds, no more, on the report that 5 more people have died from the flu in London, 14 in total now. Should we panic?
Well, no. I mean, it's unfortunately, it's a fact of life that people are going to die of some kind of something, whether it's the flu or pneumonia or something. It's a fact of life, tragically. People are going to die. Whether or not it justifies spending billions of dollars on vaccines is a whole other question, you know?
We'll get to that question in just a moment. When we come back in just a moment. I checked the Free Press this morning. The obits were there again. In spite of all the people eating broccoli, there were people still dying. In fact, if you check this morning's Free Press, one person died twice in the same column.
Oh,
check
dear.
It out. Little typo issue there. Anyway, we'll focus on the flu vaccine, whether it does any good at all. When we come back in just a moment, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
The flu continues its deadly grip on the region. 5 more deaths were reported last week by the Middlesex London Health Unit. That raises the influenza death tally this season to 14. There were 32 new laboratory-confirmed cases in the last week. More than 50% of the flu cases have been adults between the ages of 20 and 64. Flu vaccinations are still available at the health unit and at some doctor's offices and pharmacies.
Interesting report last night on CTV, and I think, Pam, we probably had a variety of reactions. People say, 5 people died. That's a total of 14 total. This is serious. Is it?
No, I don't see it. I mean, it's tragic that people die. Every time somebody dies, it's tragic. But unfortunately, it's just Mother Nature doing her thing. People die from infection sometimes just because they are immunocompromised. But we don't see people falling dead in the street these days. You know, we have improved sanitation and hygiene measures. And unfortunately, what happened was, is as we improved sanitation and hygiene here in North America, the vaccine industry took the credit for the reduction in infectious diseases. The reduction in infectious diseases had nothing to do with the vaccines. It had everything to do with improved sanitation and hygiene.
Even Steve Garrison looks at me askance when he says, "You're sure you haven't had the flu vaccine?" I said, "No, I have not had."
But even if you got the flu, big deal. It's normal to get the flu. It's normal. It's normal to get a flu or a cold.
You hear a report. Nothing wrong with the reporting last night on CTV, but you hear flu, death, flu, death. That's what you hear all the time. Flu, death, flu, death. What you don't hear is that they're almost all older.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, their health is already compromised in a serious way.
Mm-hmm.
And even if there weren't such a thing as flu, last time I checked, the obits, the last couple of weeks, have been 40 names long every day. People do die. And sometimes they're very close to death when they have...
And they systematically, every season, know how to scare people half out of their wits. So they line up for these chemicals, to inject these chemicals in their body. And instead of looking at them and saying, well, how much sugar are you eating? How much coffee are you drinking? How much alcohol are you consuming? Are you getting, you know, fresh air and sunshine every day? Blah, blah, blah. Instead of asking them about nutrition and lifestyle habits, they just inject them with chemicals. And that's allegedly going to make us healthier as a society.
Well, you have to be pretty cynical to write a book called Seeking Sickness and Selling Sickness, but he's done it. Our friend Alan Castles joins us again. Good morning, Alan. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. I'm not that cynical.
Yeah, selling sickness and seeking sickness, that's about as cynical as you can get, isn't it?
Well, I don't know about that.
We need critical voices out there, though, Alan, and you have done your research. You're a drug policy researcher at the University of Victoria. You're an author. What have you discovered in your research with regards to the flu shot?
Well, I should tell you that the flu is in the news here as well on the West Coast. There was a healthcare worker in the Lower Mainland who was fired yesterday for refusing to abide by the flu policy. So in British Columbia, if you work in the healthcare system, you have to either get the flu shot or you have to wear a mask. And this guy basically said, you know, I don't agree with the draconian policy, and they eventually fired him. So this is just another indication of the real shift in how flu policies are just being implemented in a really kind of heavy-handed way. It used to be that they would suggest people.
Alan, can I just jump in for a moment? Because I have a niece who is a nurse in Northern Ontario. She's been told the same thing. You get the flu shot, which she won't do, or wear the mask. So she's wearing the mask because she likes her job and wants to keep it.
Yep.
And they have a lovely new home that the newlyweds want to pay for. But Pam, what's your understanding? I mean, Alan's
going to confirm that there's no research to show that wearing a mask is going to help.
Right, and I want to get to all that. You have some breaking news there. Somebody has been fired, and I'm just wondering how new that is, that people are now being fired for not being willing to cooperate with this policy.
Well, it's the first case that I've heard of. It's actually in the Globe and Mail today in the BC section. So, yeah, it's really an indication of how tough they're getting. But here's the issue that I have. So the provincial health officer is kind of bragging that, you know, our flu policy has increased the rate of immunization of healthcare workers up to 80%. Last year it was somewhere between 60 and 70%. So the question I have is, so you increased it up to 80%. Where's the beef? Can you show that there are reductions in deaths or hospitalizations or so on related to the flu? Of course they can't show that.
And we have an aging population, Alan, right? Well, so if they're going to shoot themselves in the foot.
Well, you know, the way I look at it, it's almost like you're building a bridge, but you're not sure, you're paying for the bridge, but you're not sure whether it went to the other side. Here we're paying hundreds of millions of dollars for vaccines, and the provincial health officer couldn't really even tell us whether there's been any effect.
And the nurses were very critical of this public health officer because he actually has ties to the vaccine industry.
Yeah.
Well, this is so frustrating because last week, too, we concentrated on the sales of Tamiflu vaccine around the world. In Canada, I think the figure was, what, 200 to 300 million we spent here. Overall in the world, it was
at least 300 million. Yeah.
Without evidence, Alan, that it works.
Yes. And we were saying that when the countries were stockpiling this, we were writing and saying, you know, this is a quite possibly a major waste of money because these drugs are not proven to do what you think they're going to do. And now that they bought all these stockpiles in preparation for the big pandemic, they're all outdated.
And they're saying their utmost to try and defend their position. Right?
I want to ask both of you to forgive me, but this is, I'm being a newsman. I'm coming back to how our medical staff here in London are reacting to this report, Alan, that you just shared with us, that you can now be fired because I'm sure that they looked into the legalities. Yeah. Is there any indication that the courts will back up this firing, or might this person have a case? In other words, we've got a lot of people like my niece, like a lot of medical staff here in London who are under tremendous pressure to get the vaccine or wear the mask. Do they have a legal case if they want to fight that policy?
That's a very good question. I don't actually know. I don't know what sort of legal stand this person would have, though I know the union has tried to fight it, the sort of health employees union, so, and have tried to fight the policies and have, had serious negotiations with the government, and the government basically wouldn't back down. So, you know, they haven't really, I think, taken it to court, but they have really had some pretty strong negotiations.
Mm-hmm. Is the government worried that, on the other hand, someone might launch a lawsuit against them if they can make a case that some of the patients have died because one of the staff hadn't had their flu vaccine?
Yeah, who knows? I'm sure they've got their lawyers all over this, thinking up those kinds of possibilities. I don't actually know, but anything's possible.
But look at what was concluded with the Cochrane Collaborations report, basically examining the flu shot and the efficacy of the flu shot. It says a body of literature in your article, "Will a Flu Shot Keep You Healthy?" A body of literature spanning 25 studies and involving almost 60,000 people finds an annual flu shot reduced overall clinical influenza by about 6%.
Right.
A minuscule amount.
Pam, just repeat that because people are, that is an absolutely crucial fact that people can so easily miss.
Right. There's this body of research that was examined by the Cochrane Collaboration. It spans 25 studies and involved almost 60,000 people. They found an annual flu shot reduced overall clinical influenza by about 6%. 6%, Andy, that's it.
And yeah, we're spending and that's laboratory huge. Confirmed cases of flu. That is not 6% reduction in deaths. So, I mean, the news story in London about these people dying from the flu the question you have, the implication is, oh, these people weren't vaccinated. There's a good chance that they were, and the likelihood of being protected from death by a flu shot, it hasn't been proven. So even to make the implication that not having a flu shot equals death is really wrong.
Alan, I can be a bit of a jerk, and I would love to phone. I would love to phone the little London Middlesex Health Unit and say to them, of these 14 people who have died, can you tell us how many had the flu shot? They won't do it.
They won't know.
No, they won't do it.
I mean, if we're going to be open and have an open and honest discussion, wouldn't you release that information?
Absolutely. You know, people die with the flu shot or without the flu shot. In fact, Tom Jefferson, who's with the Cochrane Collaboration, when they've looked at, you know, hundreds of studies over decades, they have found no effect in terms of reductions in deaths related to the flu because of the flu shot. So really, even to make the implication that this the shot is somehow protecting people from death is really misguided.
Alan, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about a couple of larger issues about your approach to the whole issue of medicine, why you chose these titles, Seeking Sickness and Selling Sickness, and some overall comments about the state of our health. When we come back with Alan Castles in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
And next here tonight, a Brian Ross investigation about a popular brand of products. You may have heard the name. Perhaps they're in your home, Herbalife. The company says its shakes and supplements help you lose weight, live a healthy life. But tonight, hidden cameras show what some of the distributors said behind closed doors.
Okay, we hear horror stories all the time about health products, and they are simply not true. Look at the rap sheet for GlaxoSmithKline. I want to ask our guest, Alan Castles, this morning about the latest horror story when it comes to drugs, and that is Pradaxa. Alan, can you share the story, and what is the Canadian connection, specifically McMaster University?
So Pradaxa, it's the name of the drug in Canada is Pradax. The generic name is Dabigatran. So this is the first of a new class of anticoagulant drugs. So these drugs would work like warfarin. Warfarin is used to basically prevent people from having strokes, people who have atrial fibrillation. These drugs have been under a dark cloud, in my opinion, ever since they've come to market about 3 or 4 years ago. The main issue is that the drugs cause bleeding, and the bleeding is not reversible. So if you take warfarin and it causes excessive bleeding, your doctor can give you a drug called vitamin K, and that can stop the bleeding. With the new anticoagulants, there isn't such an antidote. So the problem is that people become anticoagulated, and they might get a bleeding hemorrhage to their brain or to their stomach or so on.
I don't mean to be melodramatic, but yeah. I can think of the commercial every night I see on ABC News for Pradaxa. There's this man and his daughter. And then he was taking warfarin, and she says, well, this and this and this, and that's why you should now check out Pradaxa. Now we have this horror story.
And one of the side effects is that it can kill you.
Yeah, it can. And so the question is, how much better or worse is it than warfarin? Well, when they've done the clinical trials, it isn't any better in terms of preventing strokes, and it does seem to be slightly worse in terms of causing unnecessary or excessive bleeding. The relation to Hamilton is that the drug was studied partly by researchers in Hamilton, and that research is coming under scrutiny because there's been a number of lawsuits against the company, essentially saying that they're not revealing the full extent of the dangers related to the drug. And, you know, people were injured in the clinical trials, and that information wasn't made public. And so, you know, so that's the Canadian connection.
Is McMaster University being sued then over their involvement?
I don't think they're being sued. I think that they are being dragged into the lawsuit, so they're having to, you know, present evidence and so on. But I don't know what the state of the lawsuit is, but I know that they're mired in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give a little context here, isn't warfarin basically what we know as rat poison?
Yes, it also goes by the name of Coumadin, and you know, there's probably going to be 25% of your listeners between the ages of 70 and 85 will be taking that drug. widely used.
Very widely used drug.
And, and you know, just it's effective as well. Very cheap, effective, though, like any drug, it has to be monitored closely. And see, that's how the newer anticoagulants were being sold as drugs that didn't need this close kind of monitoring. And so really being promoted on the basis of convenience, not effectiveness.
Okay, Alan, we have in the time, just judging the time here, I think we have time for two basic questions. The last one will be for you to repeat that news, that breaking news, which I think is of intense interest to medical staff here in London, about that hospital staff who decided he was not going to follow the policy of get your flu shot or wear a mask. But before we do that, just summarize your two books, Seeking Sickness and Selling Sickness. What's the key message of your two books?
Well, I think it's hard to summarize two books in one key message, but I would say that probably that there's a huge gap between what the marketers will tell you about the benefits of drugs and what they will tell you about the nature of diseases and the reality. And so there's a lot of money to be made in convincing people that they could be sick, they could be in danger, and that they need to do things.
In my world, that's called lying.
Yeah, in the marketing world, it's called, you know, effective market creation. And you know, market creation is okay for when we're talking about phones or computers, but here we're talking about your health. And so I think that I'm trying to engender a certain level of healthy skepticism.
People's lives are at stake, Alan. Why aren't more people going to prison?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. There has been some very significant lawsuits against the drug companies, though we haven't seen any of the executives in orange jumpsuits yet. My sense is that when that happens, you're going to see a serious turnaround in their sort of practices.
Yeah, and lately they've been promising that they're going to become more transparent. We had Dr. Tom Jefferson on recently, and I just have my doubts about that.
Yeah.
Okay, we just have a couple of moments left. You shared some very significant news. Pam and I, on a regular basis, are discussing this incredible pressure that medical staff, I have five sisters, four of them are nurses.
Mm-hmm.
My niece is a nurse in Northern Ontario, and she has been forced to comply with this policy. If you don't have your flu vaccine, you have to wear a mask. And we've had some vigorous debates about this particular policy. You had some breaking news on this story this morning from BC. What is it?
Well, the breaking news is that the first healthcare worker who's refused the policy has been fired, and from the health authority in Grand Forks in BC. And so this is just evidence that the health authorities are taking the policy really seriously, and people are quite possibly going to be losing their jobs if they don't comply. So, mm-hmm. You know, whether that's going to spread across the country, but it just shows how strong-armed they're getting on these basic.
Remember when we did the story, Andy, about the head of St. Joe's Hospital and how essentially she's been given financial incentives to make sure that more of the staff is vaccinated?
And do you have reason to believe, Alan, because if this has happened in BC, I can see this spreading across the country?
Well, I think so. You know, but again, if they're going to bring in mandatory policies, they need to bring in proper evaluation. And this is the thing that I'm harping on with the provincial health officer. If you can tell me that increasing the rate of immunizations is going to prevent death, show me the evidence.
There is no
evidence.
They
don't have any.
No, they don't. Yeah, they're just very good at scaring people.
This could lead to a major court case, Alan.
Yep.
I hope it does.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, when there's more further developments, I'll give you a call and we can talk about it further.
Well, we love having you.
Absolutely, because I imagine, as you say, there are lawyers piling up on both sides of this issue. If there's no evidence that flu vaccines protect you, then, you know, we may have a very good case here.
Yeah.
Are you working on any articles or books right now, Alan?
Yeah. It's funny you should mention the Cochrane Collaboration, because I wrote a book about the Cochrane Collaboration, and it's going to be coming out this summer.
Have you got a title picked already? Or
we're still working on that.
Okay.
My working title is Medicine's Best Kept Secret. I mean, I quite admire the group because of one major factor. They do lots of heavy-hitting you know, sort of medical investigation and systematic analysis, and they don't take money from the drug.
Here's a challenge before we let you go. 30 seconds of advice that will save a life or more.
Right. Second opinions are very useful, and being skeptical of anything related to your health, whether it's advice around drugs, vaccines, or other things, is very healthy, and asking questions of your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Alan, we have to run. We're out of time. We thank you so much for your time.
Okay.
Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the breaking news.
And Alan's website is alancassels.com, by the way.
And how do you spell Castles?
C-A-S-S-E-L-S. So alancassels.com.
Okay. And a final word from Pam Colleen.
I'm teaching actually at the library starting April 30th. I'm teaching my two-part digestion class, and people can find out more information about it on my website, which is just my name, pamcolleen.com.
And the single biggest health issue out there today that you're seeing?
Well,
Where do you start?
I mean, I think we have no choice but to return to basics when it comes to what we're choosing to eat and our activity levels and so on. So we've got to take more control of our health on our own. We can't rely on experts, unfortunately.
There we go. Pam Colleen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And
Thanks, of course, Andy.
You can go to Pam Colleen's website, pam@pamcolleen.com. 11 o'clock news coming up next on the other